The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Monday, August 19th at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting at the downtown fire station in the council chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for the meeting agenda and how to attend online. On Thursday, August 22nd at 4 p.m., there will be a city council work session held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. For more information on the meeting, including on how to join the meeting online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
This is Explorin' Lauren with another ecological report for KORC. Yet another endangered species has been spotted in the state of Oregon. You may have heard that in late June, a pair of sea otters were seen in Ecola State Park near Cannon Beach. If you're thinking, well, I've seen a sea otter at the beach before, remember that nowadays it is the common river otter, Lantra canadensis, who ventures into saltwater environments, while the sea otter in Hydra lutris has been extirpated or killed off from Oregon waters for over a century. More on that later. As reported by OPB, conservationists with the nonprofit Ilaca Alliance confirmed the sightings of two male sea otters in June. The Ilaca Alliance is a group of tribal, nonprofit, and conservation leaders based in Siletz who are working to restore a healthy population of sea otters on the Oregon coast as part of the larger effort to maintain robust and resilient marine ecosystems. Small populations of sea otters cling to the central California coast, while around 2,000 live on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, from which the Ecola Beach visitors appear to have come. Biologists say that male otters are known to occasionally venture some distance from their pack in search of mates, though unfortunately these individuals aren't likely to be joined by females. At 30 to 100 pounds, sea otters are the largest of the mustelids, which include weasels, badgers, martens, and wolverines. They inhabit near-shore environments where they forage on invertebrates like sea urchins, crabs, clams and mussels, and innkeeper worms during dives that last 1 to 4 minutes. This diet plays a crucial role in maintaining the health of kelp forest ecosystems, many of which are infested with urchins on the Oregon coast due to a lack of predators. The earliest sea otter fossils are only about 2 million years old in modern-day Hokkaido, Japan, from where it spread to the Aleutian Islands and down the North American coast. While seals evolved at least 20 million years ago, otters are in some respects more adapted to water than seals, who have to haul out on land or ice to give birth. Its hind feet are fully webbed to propel it through the water, and its large kidneys enable it to derive fresh water from drinking seawater. According to the Sea Otter Foundation Trust, while they hunt and groom alone, sea otters are somewhat social creatures, floating in gender-based groups called rafts of up to several hundred individuals. They have an adorable tendency to wrap themselves or their young in kelp to avoid drifting away while they sleep. Their long and sensitive whiskers can help sea otters find prey by touch in dark or turbid waters. One fascinating behavioral adaptation is the sea otter's use of tools, exhibiting its intelligence and adaptability. Storing the perfect rock in a pouch under their leg, an otter will float on their back and use their chest as a surface to crack open shellfish and access the soft, tasty flesh inside. Mothers, who devotedly perform all tasks of feeding and raising offspring, must begin teaching this skill to pups early on, until about 6 to 8 months of age. Grooming is an essential daily routine, when they clean and fluff their fur to maintain its insulation properties and prevent cold seawater from making direct contact with their skin. Their dense fur coat can contain over 1 million hairs per square inch, the densest of any living mammal, which keeps them dry and warm without the thick blubber that many other marine mammals have. While their lack of blubber is unique, some evolutionary theorists think that aquatic adaptation will eventually favor blubber. This is because as otters dive to deeper, colder water while foraging, the layer of air beneath their fur becomes compressed and loses its insulating power. This creates a possible disadvantage, which requires otters to replace the lost heat energy with a higher food intake. This evolutionary adaptation of dense fur is key to why sea otter populations are missing from the Oregon coast. By the early 20th century, only 1,000 to 2,000 individuals were thought to remain in the world, with hunting being the main cause of decline. Melinda Jett of the Oregon History Project summarizes the history of the otter fur trade in the Northwest coast. The sea otter played a pivotal role in the history of the Northwest coast beginning in the late 18th century. At that time, sea otters were present across a vast region stretching from the Sea of Japan in the North Pacific to the Sea of Cortez in Baja California. By the late 18th century, a market for sea otter furs had developed in northern China, owing to the tastes of the Manchu upper class, who prized the furs for their warmth and especially luxurious appearance. What distinguished the otter pelts from the other furs was the density, thickness, and lustrous quality of the animal's hair, characteristics resulting from their lack of insulating body fat. The Russians were the first Europeans to exploit the sea otter, beginning in the 1740s. Over the next several decades, Russian entrepreneurs known as promyshleniks outfitted trading expeditions to Alaska, beginning in the Aleutian Islands and moving progressively eastward to the Gulf of Alaska. British and American entrepreneurs entered the sea otter trade on the Northwest coast in the mid-1780s. The official count of Captain James Cook's expedition to the Northwest coast, published in 1784, had sparked interest in the trade since it noted the high returns that could be garnered for sea otter skins in China. British and American entrepreneurs competed aggressively in the early years, but by the 1790s, American ships hailing from Boston came to dominate the maritime fur trade on the Northwest coast. This dominance was the result of several factors. Russian trading efforts were hampered by the long supply lines between their bases in Alaska and cities in eastern Russia, and by the fact that the main Chinese port of Canton was closed to Russian traders. British vessels also suffered from British trade practices that forced them to obtain licenses from the South Sea Company and the East Indian Company. In contrast, Americans enjoyed open access to the Canton markets and a shorter sailing time on the trade triangle from Boston to the Northwest coast to China and back to Boston. From the 1790s and through the 1810s, scores of British, Russian, and American vessels plied the Northwest for sea otters, trading with various native groups throughout Alaska, British Columbia, and parts of Washington and Oregon. As overhunting depleted one region of its sea otter population, the fur trade would move on to another area. After 1810, the sea otter trade slowly diminished throughout the Northwest coast, and by the 1840s, the once plentiful sea otters had been driven to the brink of extinction. In the late 20th century, protective legislation and the concerted efforts of marine biologists, conservationists, native groups, and lovers of the sea otter stimulated the recovery of sea otters in Pacific coast waters. Indigenous North American groups would have known the sea otter from the first coastal migrations along the Pacific Rim from Asia to North America tens of thousands of years ago. Otter bones are commonly found among coastal middens in Oregon. Middens are an archaeological term for layers of bone, shell, charcoal, hearthstone, and other artifacts from prehistoric human occupations. This evidence, along with indigenous oral histories, reflects a long, sustainable balance between otter and human populations for millennia before the colonial invasions began in the 18th century. The Alaka Alliance notes how elders throughout the coast attest to the historical importance of sea otter robes as precious items of wealth and status, serving as gifts during diplomacy and payment during marriage arrangements. In traditional stories, otter skins are a common prize that comes to protagonists who are savvy, powerful, or lucky. Other stories emphasize that sea otters were viewed as respected kin, linked to the natural cycles that bring people food and prosperity. While it isn't likely that the recent sea otter sightings in Oregon indicate a natural population rebound, local biologists and other advocates like the Alaka Alliance continue to study their foraging habits and life cycle in hopes of someday reintroducing a population of these masters of the kelp forest.
Hey, remember that former president who tried to steal an election? He's going to try it again. Trump supporters are implementing a strategy of embedding themselves in the administrative side of the election so they can subvert the certification of the election if the outcome is not in Trump's favor. This is not fiction. It's already happened. In the 2022 midterms, at least 10 Republican-dominated counties in Pennsylvania and Arizona refused to certify accurate election results. In the Georgia primary last May, a Republican member of the Fulton County Elections Board would not certify election results. It's going to happen again in many counties and many states in the national election. It's happened recently in Michigan, and now this. At a recent Georgia rally, ex-president and convicted felon Donnie Trump acknowledged from the podium three members of local election boards. When does a presidential candidate recognize members of local election boards? Maybe when there's an evil plan afoot, I'd say. This is, Republicans must feel, the only way to win a national election. Steal it. This is clearly the Republican strategy. Block certification locally, which could block state certification, which could what? I'll let you fill in the blanks. Democrats think this particular election will be far worse because the GOP is far more organized and obviously all in on the strategy of denying a democratically elected president. The founder of Democracy Docket, Mark Elias, said this is just another way for Republicans to undermine legitimate elections. If it couldn't be done at the local level, they try at the state level. Denied there? They tried the fake elector routine. If that doesn't work, try dozens of frivolous lawsuits, all thrown out in court. Okay, last resort, storm the Capitol building and lynch the Republican vice president, preventing him from certifying the election. The whole Republican strategy is illegal, immoral, and reprehensible, also known as business as usual. You don't like a group of voters? Prevent them from voting or make it incredibly hard to vote. You don't like the election results? Don't certify them and throw the country into chaos. The Republicans have looked back at 2020 and didn't care for what they saw. They've now prepared for 2024. It's already evident as fake electors have been charged with crimes and fake lawyers like Rudy, the red-nosed Giuliani, have been disbarred. They are just a few of the victims yet to be counted. Elias, who represented President Biden against many of the ridiculous lawsuits following the 2020 election, has these suggestions. Promote democracy everywhere. Speak out when you see this behavior or see it promoted. Use social media to point out the bad political players who are on these local election boards for the sole purpose of denying legitimate results. What will that look like locally? probably non-existent in western Oregon, but will certainly be in play in the red portion of the state. You know, Greater Idaho, or whatever they call it. I like to call it Lesser Oregon. For KORC News, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
Hey, this is Phil Farrell for KORC, and I got an interview with Seattle rock group King Youngblood. Now, this took place on Friday, August 16th at Common Fields in Corvallis, Oregon. So, let's get right to it. So this is Phil Farrell on KORC. I'm here at Common Fields, and I'm here with King Youngblood, who just tore the house down. So, what's up?
How's it going, man?
Hey, what's up? What's up? How you doing, man?
Us. Yeah, it was good.
I'm doing good. That was an awesome show, you guys.
Bayless, how's it going? Oh, man, I gotta say, you guys gotta go.
So, I understand this is your first time performing in Corvallis?
That's right, yeah. First time in Corvallis, you know, for us, I think too often we see that so many national bands and national acts skip over the towns that have the super fans, skip over the towns that have the places where you get to have those really intimate moments of still throwing a stadium arena level show, but for folks that get a chance to see it really, really raw and without all the bells and whistles, get to really see the songs. And we're stoked to be here in Corvallis, and we're really grateful for folks having us over here at Common Fields.
Yeah, thank you. So you're from Seattle, right?
That's right, yeah. Seattle, Washington. We've been playing together for coming up on about a year and a half since Paul joined.
It'd been a year and a half since I joined with them, the drummer. So
yeah.
Now how long have you been in the band?
I think we're going on two years and some change.
Almost two and a half years.
It's been a blessing. It's been a pleasure. I've learned so much. These guys are very patient, very caring, and they have so much grace. And it's a pleasure to work with these lads.
Yeah, we love you too. We love you too, bro. We love you too.
Okay. So, being from Seattle, I'm sure you've performed in Oregon before, around here.
Yeah, no, definitely. The last time we played in Oregon
was yesterday.
Aside from yesterday, we had a show on this tour in Ashland. But before that, we actually put on a music festival called Black and Loud Fest for folks in particular that look like me and Paul. In the rock world, there's not a lot of folks that look like us.
And how do we look?
Well, we're black. Right. And so for us, we wanted to create something to showcase that not only are black artists doing, you know, genres outside of just hip-hop and R&B and all the love for those genres, massive inspirations for us, but especially in the alternative spaces and rock and metal and in anything, you know, kind of more indie, black folks are usually not receiving the same type of spotlight or support when it comes to those genres, and we wanted to do something about it. So we partnered with Jack Daniels. Shout out Jack Daniels.
To put
on a music festival that celebrates black-fronted bands that everybody is invited to, regardless of your shade, size, orientation, any of that. We wanted to hold space for folks that are underrepresented and give people a chance not just to give their flowers, but to really be a part of some of the most incredible music that there is out there that is coming from black-fronted bands.
Yeah. Actually, that kind of covered a question I was going to get to, because myself, I'm a mixed race person.
Nice.
I do, my mom is Japanese, Puerto Rican, my dad's white, just get that out the way. So I do a hip hop show, cool. And I always try to emphasize the black origins of hip hop.
Yeah.
And so one question I was going to ask you is, how important do you feel it is to bring rock and roll back to its origins as a black genre?
I mean, truthfully, you know, and the same reason why we put Black and Loud Fest together, honestly, that's really the ethos of King Youngblood in and of itself. You know, for rock music in particular, it's far too often that we see white folks getting credit for things that black folks originated. And rock music, unfortunately, is another story of underrepresented folks not getting their due credit. Not even just from the realm of, you know, honestly, you can go back so many different places with it. You can go Sister Rosetta Tharpe came up with everything Elvis Presley ever attempted. Tina Bell is the godmother of grunge music, but yet everybody only knows, you know, the big bands that by all means deserve their credit. But yet again, we see that black folks are not being given their due credit, and we want to make sure that we're giving people their flowers now rather than when they pass, or talking about these things now rather than when it's, you know, in post. We'd rather this be something that we get a chance to share and create a community through, rather than just be something we talk about in textbooks or online.
And another
thing that really brings up to mind is just knowing from each background from where we all come from. For me and Sammy here, you know, we come from a gospel church background. You know, we're PKs, preacher's kids. Okay. You know, and it's like we're stationed only and, you know, bound to only one genre or just kind of limited, you know, in that genre. But then when we get to step out the box and actually be ourselves, we find this rock that we never knew that was in us, and you know, it comes out and expresses out, and it's like, hey, this is just another gift from God that we utilize and that we use, and it's like, hey, we get to share this with others, and others get to be touched by it just the same way as if we do like in the church. So it's this good feeling that we have that we get to share with our brothers and sisters, but not only to our brothers and sisters, but like just to fans and people out there. So yes,
yeah, 100%. And growing up, it was almost taboo to do rock music.
Yeah.
Where I was growing up in a Latino community, you're Puerto Rican. My mom's Puerto Rican. My pop's from El Salvador, and it's just like, what, rock music? And it took my family a minute to understand that not only is this rock music, but this is
our music.
Right, this is a mixture of gospel, grunge, metal, funk, everything. Yeah. Everything you need, we have that in our music. And what we say is seek hearts, not applause.
Come on.
Because we could do a show where there's three people there and it doesn't matter if there's one person that gets touched, that's what matters.
Yes.
You feel me? And it could be a black or brown little kid and they're seeing us up here, right? And my brothers right here.
I didn't know we could do that.
100%.
Right.
And my buddies, they be coming to the show. We come 9, 10, 15 deep and they would never listen to this music. But the support, right? They see somebody like y'all, us.
Right.
They're doing that and they get motivated and they get inspired, and that's what it's about. It's about seeking hearts, not applause.
And it's insane. We do for three people in the audience, we do for 3,000. And it's that's kind of hard in the mindset that we have.
The energy was crazy out there. Especially at the end when you jumped off stage and jumped on the table.
Have to do it, man. I think I'm a big believer in, we want, when people come to King Youngblood shows, you're not just coming to a show, you're coming to an experience, and we want you to be a part of that.
Yeah, definitely was. So like he was saying, with kind of people who support it, maybe not usually listening to this type of music. Now myself, my dad was a huge rock and roll fan, so I was always played in the house. Myself, I'm a hip hop person. I do a hip hop show, but I actually came across one of your songs like a month or two ago, and I ended the show saying, "Let's play something different." Just the whole vibe, and just like you said, supporting a black rock and roll artist, and
that's love, man. Yeah, thank you. No,
so the song I played actually was the one you opened up with.
The Yacoubian Antics. Come on.
Wow,
that makes sense, man.
I don't think nobody else would have did that. Like, they were really right. It's like, oh, let's take the little mellow just sort of ease
into
it.
Yacoubian's
like right there in
that
your
one.
Face.
Yeah. And I was telling myself, I was like, there's no way they're going to come with that one first.
We have to.
And you did. Oh, and I was
for us, you
every
know,
show.
Especially being black and brown, for us, we're so used to being outcasts or outsiders to some degree everywhere we go in our day-to-day lives. And so when we're here together on stage, it is the one place we really genuinely and truly get to be ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's important that when we do that, we got to set the tone right. That's why we open with it.
Unapologetically. Yeah. It's just how we are. Yeah.
Great song. Yeah, I know some people are like, I'm not sure exactly what it's about.
I think that's the beauty of it. It's definitely a covert message, but I want the people listening to do their research.
Just look it up.
I am always grateful when people finally reach out to me and they're like, hey, what does Yacoubian mean? And then I send them the lyrics. I don't even tell them what it means. I just send them the lyrics, and then there's a light that goes off in their head, and then they come back and they're like, oh, dude.
Yeah.
You know?
First verse. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But thank you, man. That's love.
No, thank you for doing that.
Yeah, my brother-in-law from Chicago, Marcus, he put me up on that whole thing.
Wow.
He was with The Nation back in the day.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Nice.
So, yeah, I was just came across that song and just I loved it. And I saw the flyer yesterday here in town. I was like, oh, they're going to be here? Yeah. Like, man, I have to show up.
Dude,
so,
thank you, man.
That's why
I just. Common Fields.
Common Fields.
Yeah.
That was an awesome show. I actually stay in Eugene. Have you guys ever done a show there?
Oh yeah, we played at what is it, John Henry's?
Okay.
John Henry's.
So the people that just came from Seattle that were here, they were suggesting that they were to give Laura a contact that's a promoter out there.
Oh, to go play.
And they're like, yeah, you guys ought to play at Eugene's. And
yeah,
they mentioned John Henry's.
Our manager Laura, she got her law degree at the University of Oregon, mm-hmm. so like Eugene is right there.
Yeah.
I will gladly say, go Ducks.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
go Ducks.
Oh, my friend,
friend
Louis, he'll be really appreciate a Go Ducks.
But no, man, yeah, we've been out to Eugene. I think the next time we're booked for an Oregon show is probably Black and Loud Portland. We're coming back to the Bossa Nova Ballroom in April. Folks go to blackandloudfest.com or better yet on Instagram. They can join the mailing list or just follow us on Instagram and you'll know the next time that it gets all set up.
But we have one coming out next month, September 14th, Black and Loud in Seattle at the Crocodile. We're doing our Black and Loud Seattle there and we will be performing.
Yeah.
And we'd love to see those that will be out there in town around that time. Mm-hmm. That'd be great to have you.
I would say this humbly, that this is one of the biggest events in Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not only because of its purpose behind that, but just the people that are coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the biggest events in Seattle.
Remember
thy name.
Yes.
Thy name.
Yeah.
This is for everybody. Black and Loud, September 14th. Not only. Привет, сюда, Кудас Айленд.
It'll be at the Crocodile. Yeah, we'd love to see everybody there.
Yeah.
All right. You guys got a new album coming out?
Yes, we do. Yeah. We actually just listened through a good majority of the demos for the album
today.
On the ride to the gig here today. Huh. But we have a new album. We're still jumping around on a couple of names, but I think, truthfully, I think we're pretty much there on it.
I'll say this much. I'm the drummer. I have already recorded my part, and being in the studio and knowing what's to come, you guys, get ready. I have to tell you, this album is going to be something crazy. It's going to be something that you don't expect. It's going to be meaningful. I mean, we were all tearing up just hearing the demo of what's about to come.
Real.
And I tell you, it's not only the musicality part of it, but the lyrics. And then what this whole CD means is going to blow people's minds. So I say, stay tuned for the next album to come. I'm ready. I'm ready for it to be born. I'm ready for it to give birth and just out to everybody. Listen to those ears out there.
Yeah. So, if anybody wants to check out more, we've got 2 sneak peeks right now. Nothing is released on Spotify or Apple Music, but if you go to our YouTube channel, just King Youngblood Music on YouTube, you'll be able to see 2 tracks off of that album.
Our music video.
Yeah, our music video, I Don't Care, just came out, which is one of the songs on the new album. Yeah, yeah. And before that, we did our NPR Tiny Desk with our song Outrun Your Shadow with our full string section. If folks want to check out some really powerful music, go check out our YouTube.
Okay. And then where else could they find maybe the past releases?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere you listen to music. Our album Big Thank is out now on Spotify, Apple Music, anywhere you like to listen to music. And really, just the support doesn't just go a long way, but it really makes the difference in reminding us why this purpose is so important. And truthfully, it's because we get to share it with you.
Yeah.
Sweet. Well, any other anything else you guys want to say to the people, why you got their ear?
Come to Black and Loud. Seattle is not that far away.
It's not.
Come to Black and Loud.
Stay tuned for the next album to come. I'm telling you, it will be something that you never, ever expected it to be.
King Youngblood, remember that name. Hey, yo, what's good, man? We are
King Youngblood.
And you're listening to KORC
105.9
Radio.
Hey, yo.
Yeah.
Cool.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The following is an article from the Oregonian entitled, Oregon Labor Bureau Says It Will Dismiss Hundreds of Workers' Claims Without $22 Million Budget Increase, written by Carlos Fuentes. The Oregon Labor Bureau has asked Governor Tina Kotek and lawmakers to increase its budget by roughly $22 million so it can tackle massive backlogs of complaints from workers who say they've been illegally denied pay or had their civil rights violated. The agency is requesting $81.2 million, a steep 36% increase from its current budget, for the 2-year period that begins next July, KOTEC will consider proposals from state agencies as she works to craft a recommended budget for the legislature to review and finalize next year. Anka Matika, a spokesperson for the governor, did not respond to a question from the Oregonian Oregon Live asking if KOTEC would support the Bureau of Labor and Industry's budget request. Representative Tana Sanchez, a Democrat from Portland and co-chair of the Budget Writing Committee, said it is too early to know if there is room in the budget to grant the agency's request. The request, however, is wildly out of line with KOTEC's instructions to most state agencies, not including the Labor Bureau, to limit their budget request increases for next year to 1% or less above their current service levels. KOTEC can't direct Labor Bureau actions in the way she can direct most state agencies because it is helmed by an independently elected state labor commissioner. Without the additional funding, leaders say the agency will have to dismiss hundreds or possibly thousands of claims, which include potential child labor law violations, as well as allegations of employers paying workers less than minimum wage, not providing legally required breaks, or retaliating against employees. Quote, "The robust pro-worker laws passed by the Oregon legislature to protect Oregonians are at risk of becoming meaningless if the agency tasked with enforcing them is not adequately funded," the agency warned in a press release last Friday. The Labor Bureau employs 149 full-time workers and has a current two-year budget of $59.6 million. But agency leaders say it's not enough to address a growing backlog of thousands of workers' wages claims and civil rights complaints. The agency's Civil Rights Division, which investigates workplace harassment and discrimination, as well as housing discrimination, has seen an 110% increase in questionnaires from individuals seeking to file a complaint since 2020, according to the agency. The Wage and Hour Division, which investigates labor law violations, has seen a 208% increase in claims and complaints in the last 4 years. Quote, "Despite this exponential growth in demand, the division has not received the necessary investment to expand its capacity accordingly," agency spokesperson Rachel Mann said in an email. The surge in claims has led to backlogs at virtually every step of the investigative process, according to the agency. As of August 12th, the Labor Bureau had 408 open wage investigations and an additional 3,450 wage claims that either hadn't been reviewed or assigned an investigator, according to agency data. That doesn't include an additional 1,736 complaints that the Wage and Hour Division has received regarding other issues, including alleged child labor law violations or denials of meal and rest breaks. In addition, the Civil Rights Division has consistently faced a backlog of 1,200 to 2,000 inquiries that have yet to be reviewed, Mann said. Labor Commissioner Christina Stevenson told the Senate Labor and Business Committee in May that it was taking more than a year for the agency to resolve wage claims. For civil rights complaints, the average wait time is 2 years, according to a memo detailing the agency's budget requests. Quote, "Workers are left vulnerable, with some waiting years to see any form of resolution," the memo states. It continues, "For those struggling to make ends meet, these delays can be catastrophic, leading to loss of housing, inability to afford basic necessities, and ongoing exposure to discriminatory practices or wage theft." The Labor Bureau says understaffing and an outdated case management system have strained its capacity. Stevenson has taken several steps to increase the agency's resources since entering office in 2023. The agency streamlined its online intake form process, hired new investigators, and worked with the state to increase employee recruitment and retention, among other efforts. But the Labor Bureau says it needs the additional funding to better address its woes. It's requesting $16.6 million to fund 62 new positions, 32 of which would be workers in the Wage and Hour and Civil Rights Divisions. Its remaining monetary requests would pay for the replacement of this case management system and additional support staff. Stevenson warned the Senate Labor and Business Committee in May that not funding these new positions and modernization efforts would force the agency to start rejecting approximately 70% of workers' wage and hour claims. Quote, "We're going to have to establish an earnings threshold. So what that means is if you make more than $60,000, I don't think we can take your claim," Stevenson said. "Maybe we don't take overtime claims, maybe we don't take agreed rate claims, meal and rest break claims. and I think in order to sleep at night, we're going to have to rework our processes to make sure that we can help workers somehow have these laws enforced, unquote. Again, that was an article from the Oregonian entitled, Oregon Labor Bureau Says It Will Dismiss Hundreds of Workers' Claims Without $22 Million Budget Increase, written by Carlos Fuentes, who covers state politics and government. You're listening to KORC.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. You can hear this program Sundays from 1 to 2, and Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. We archive every program at our website, KORCFM.com. Corvallis area residents are invited to participate in a free edible garden tour being offered by the Corvallis Sustainability Coalition's Food Action Team. This tour welcomes both new and experienced gardeners, as well as anyone who wants to see local food-producing gardens. The tour is going to take place August 29th, that's a Thursday, from 5 to 8 p.m. It's a self-guided tour of six gardens in Northeast Corvallis that feature a variety of edibles. The tour locations include the Corvallis Waldorf School, which is located at 3855 Northeast Highway 20, 1026 Northeast Angeli Place, 2942 Northeast Glacier Way, 2825 Northeast Conzer Street, 3550 Northeast Canterbury Circle, and 1680 Northeast Holly Oak Place. Participants are welcome to begin their tour at any of the above sites and determine the order which you would like to visit the various gardens. Host gardeners will be on hand to talk to participants about the gardens and to answer questions. There are tour maps and free copies of the 2024 Corvallis Garden Resource Guide available at each of these sites. There's more information on this event. It's Thursday, August 29th, the Edible Garden Tour in Northeast Corvallis. There's more information at sustainablecorvallis.org, or for more information, you can call 541-230-1237. This is KORC.
This is the Chef of Love, Chef Gennard, TV host and restaurateur. My grandparents harvested their land to sell food and shared its overflowing bounty with our community. Grandma said, for every yam we pick, we give one away. In the world they cultivated, I love preparing and eating dinner with my family on Sundays. When our resources changed, food assistance programs sustained us. They gave me fuel to start my first culinary business at 16 years old, and inspiration to donate the extra food in my community. Through my life, I've developed an appetite to work with others to ensure everyone has access to the nutritious food we need to thrive. Together, we can help end hunger. Come on, join the movement with Feeding America by volunteering, donating, and advocating. Learn more at feedingamerica.org/act now.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ag Council.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Trevor Sayre. On Monday, August 19th at 6 p.m., the Corvallis City Council will be holding a meeting at the downtown fire station in the Council Chambers, 400 Northwest Harrison Boulevard. The meeting will also be held virtually. See CorvallisOregon.gov for the meeting agenda and how to attend online. On Thursday, August 22nd at 4 p.m., there will be a City Council work session held in person at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room, 500 Southwest Madison Avenue, as well as virtually. For more information on the meeting, including on how to join the meeting online, see CorvallisOregon.gov. For KORC News, Music, and Civics, I'm Trevor Sayre.
This is Explorin' Lauren reporting from Interzone Cafe on Monroe Avenue in Corvallis with a deadly serious question for our audience. Have you ever heard of a cello goblin? You're hearing the sounds of Rashad Eggleston, also known as Rashadicus, the cello goblin, who travels the world cello in hand, sharing the music and language from the land of Sneth. Based on the California coast, Rashadicus is often on his way to the next town, cello in hand, to share his music with a global network of devoted fans and supporters, and whoever may wander in off the street. He was professionally trained on the cello at Berklee College of Music in Boston on a full scholarship, later releasing Grammy-nominated albums. Eggleston has also served as an instructor at fiddle and string camps for the likes of Mark O'Connor and Mike Block, and has guest lectured at many colleges and universities. Here in the summer of 24, he found himself in Corvallis to climb some trees and to climb the walls of Bombs Away Cafe as he conjured his music from the land of Sneth. The next morning, KORC had a chance to catch up with Rashad Eggleston at Interzone Cafe. His Toyota Prius was packed to the brim with cellos, ready to roll on to his next show in Olympia.
He'll have some of those really dense mega metal moments. Sweet. With, you know what I mean? Because I guess what I would want to have represented on the radio is when I was really in the zone, riffing hard, doing abstract growl vocals, and then hitting some blasts of kazoo triumph.
Awesome.
And that's like, you know, kind of like the main default thing. And the other things are just to break it up, you know, to do a Baroque interlude or...
Well, those moments that you're referring to are what I'm interested in capturing around town for community radio. You seem to get out just about every year, right? Just
out this way?
Just like do a tour of some kind.
Yeah, you know, I've always dug it here and somehow, because I met these fiddle kids that lived here, and they did a fiddle camp at their house many years ago, 2005 and 6, and it was in Corvallis. So then I've been coming to Corvallis since 2001 when I was on tour with this fiddle chick, and she was came through here.
Yeah,
so
it's got a little cadre of
cool
weird people.
I like it. And what was it that you were saying before that? I can't remember.
Oh, I just try to focus on...
Oh, you that I tour every year.
Yeah.
And I tour all the time, more than once a year, for sure. Like, you know, as long as I don't get stuck in some city with a girlfriend, then I pretty much am just on tour, you know, a lot of the time.
But you're open to having the sales change direction mid-tour?
What happens is I go out on tour and then never come home.
Yeah.
Because I meet somebody. And then I'm just like, you know, my life is spontaneous. So I'm like, oh, why not just move there for a while? Sounds good. But I'm trying to actively prevent against that, because that seems to really put the brakes on my whole momentum and progress as a, you know.
Mm-hmm. Where have you spent most time? Like, which city or region have you spent most time in the last couple years?
Well, I was living in Nashville for a bit for that reason, but my home zone is in Carmel, California. But I'm thinking about moving to Oregon because I like it so much up here. And it has the best trees, you know? I mean, I like the trees in California, of course, wonderful trees also, but I mean, every city in Oregon seems to just have these amazingly tall trees just around, and they're so beautiful because they're fir trees, and those are my favorite. And I've climbed two at night so far here.
Yeah. Cedars are great, too, because they have those branches that come almost all the way down.
Oh, big swoopers?
Yeah, it's red cedar. And I think part of this is that OSU and Corvallis, OSU used to be an horticultural college, so it's got that heritage of going way back. So in May, June, this town just explodes with exotic species,
flowers,
foliage,
and
flowers. Nice. And there's even some trees on campus here that had gone up in space with the Apollo mission.
Yeah, I climbed that one last night.
No way.
Yeah, these kids took me to it, and I was like, well, I gotta climb the moon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
rope ladder to the moon.
Yeah, as if it wasn't already moon-like enough. Because, you know, when you get to the very top of a tree, it's very rare and precious and lonely, mystical, almost spooky atmosphere, especially fir trees. Because, you know, like the top of pine, sometimes they're kind of like a crown, and there's like some zones up there, or a cypress, you know. But like on top of a fir tree is like very thin and pointy, and it's just you up there, like way up on a tower. So exciting.
Yeah, not a place where human creatures spend much time usually.
Yeah, and the crows notice that. When they freak out. I've had a few times where 30, 40, 50 crows will be cawing and circling the tree, being like, what is going on?
They probably remember you from last year.
That's what I think. Yeah.
Going to a place where the birds are down beneath me. I'm going to a place where the troubles of the world can't reach me. Swaying gently in the breeze, high atop the canopies. My heart feels pierced in the tops of the tall green trees. And I'm going to a place with a view that the rich folks can't get. Skipping through the forest like Mother Nature's dance bed. Suddenly I'm not crying, I'm looking at the birds and I'm flying. My heart feels pierced in the tops of the tall green trees. Way out on the ocean I see endless white caps. Turquoise water crashing on the rocks through the pines. The misty wind that's blowing keeps the neon mosses growing. And I'll be back for as long as I'm alive. Cause I'm going to a place where the triumph is resounding. Staring at the sun to see its pink unrounding. Who needs to run or buy when there's free castles in the sky? My heart feels freest in the tops of the tall green trees. In the tops of the tall green trees.
What were we talking about? Music. Just wondering if you have any thoughts on small town music scenes, because you're clearly open to just coming to places where there's a little group of people that you like, and that there's a nice cafe that you like, and you know, it's a different economy, a different pace of creativity than a metro area.
That's true, it is. Well, it tends to bring out, you know, the weird people in town, or what, you know, sometimes maybe more normal people getting to see something that they wouldn't normally see, and both of those things are cool to play for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like bringing a certain energy of abstractness or weirdness to a zone, because you know when they're like, keep so and so weird, they make those bumper stickers. Yeah, that's my job. Come and give them a dose. Maybe it's too dense, you know, it's like a bouillon cube or something, a vegan bouillon cube. It's like you just need a little bit. So I come and they do I do 2 hours or whatever. Maybe they can only hang for half an hour or 45 minutes, but they definitely get their concentrated dose of jick, and then they can go and have the rest of their normal lives be a little bit more saucy, flavorful.
Yeah, well, I think Corvallis can use that concentrated hit every year.
yeah, for sure. You know, they're saying that the future of the cafe is uncertain, and so I made sure to give it a proper dusting in terms of, I climbed up on the speaker there and went up, you know, there's like 1 foot between the speakers and the ceiling. And I got up in there and played it up on my stomach.
Nice.
And with the cello hanging down, feeding back in the speakers.
It sounded pretty good in there.
It sounded great, yeah, up there, because I was like, my whole body was vibrating with the vibrations of the speakers, which were feeding back, and it was exciting.
Yeah.
Unique experience.
Do you only have one cello?
No, I have like four.
Okay.
But I have my main cello, which I chose to not bring on this tour because I knew it was going to be a really wild and physical tour, because there's a lot of catharsis that needs to happen and a certain level of, I need to get physically activated and involved in the show in order to really get kind of like turned on,
get to that place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's come about, but it's just kind of how it goes, you know? And also, I think it excites the people and it keeps them interested, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because the show has, of course, a musical aspect and then a visual aspect. And perhaps an olfactory aspect, which, you know, if you're moving around, then people can, even if they don't realize it, they're experiencing you on, in a primal way. And,
yeah, it's like the sound waves are actually changing with psychoacoustics, like the neural patterns in their brain. It's almost like, I mean, I use the word magic to describe it, but because, you know, it's just pressure waves in the air and watching someone on stage, and yet it can evoke these emotions and this whole journey in your mind just from rubbing some horsehair on a string.
Yeah. I use synthetic hair, by the way, because it doesn't break.
Yes.
And fortunately, it's vegan, too.
We got that on record. Thank you.
Yeah, it's all good. But that, that's cool to know that the psychoacoustic qualities, you saying it changes people's perception. Something changes the perception of the sound. Maybe the pheromones change how the sound is experienced.
Oh, yeah.
It could be the smell of excitement.
Probably all kinds of chemicals.
Yeah. Well, that's around. Another reminder to... Well, see, because I'm always, even in an interview right, like this, I'm always looking for little ways to improve my performance and my attitude about the performance, which is what improves it. You know what I mean? And so when talking about that, I am reminded that perhaps they can smell my emotions, and which is all the more important for me to not be broadcasting fear and insecurity up there, you know what I mean? Because, I mean, it isn't always the same. Some nights you feel like just like a golden god, and some nights you feel like a beheaded duck, you know, with no clothes on or whatever, you know, all naked up there and vulnerable. And but it feels important to like hold it down and be like really standing in your power, you know. But maybe not only for your own feeling about it, but so that you can broadcast the right subconscious chemicals to the people, that they can smell it. And smelling those chemicals, it's the secret key to unlock the order in the chaotic music, that they can find a pattern in there, because it is very chaotic these days, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's just what makes me happy.
You feel like music kind of can open a door, maybe away from that feeling of chaos, if you let it on stage, or am I getting too abstract?
I like getting abstract.
I'm coming from this hospital gig where I'm playing the oud. It's a fretless lute, and it's got a deep... It goes down to low C.
Oh, nice.
And that's supposed to be... I try to create a healing sort of atmosphere. It's accessing a different kind of energy than I think what you're bringing with the high intensity, powerful, bright and colorful sounds. And it's just a different process, but it's still trying to impart or maybe evoke a sort of healing kind of atmosphere through the music.
Yeah, for sure.
But a relaxing.
There's lots of different kinds of healing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's a bath, and there's like gentle massage, and then there's like karate chopping, like intense stepping on you massage. You know what I mean? So
yeah, death metal shows can heal people.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I know a lot of people that I know that are into death metal and black metal and stuff, extreme metal, describe the relaxing quality that it puts them to sleep and stuff. Like I used to put on Immortal Battles in the North. It's a really good black metal album, and go to sleep to it. It would be like 5 minutes of it, and I'd be asleep.
Yeah, just kind of neutralize your consciousness.
Exactly. Yeah, because it's almost like The way I experience it is that music at a certain intensity is what's needed to match the intensity of the thoughts that come from living in such a crazy world, you know what I mean? And it's all with all the screens and all the info you're taking in all day, just like mainlining just hell of words of all kinds and news items and updates and other people's lives and thoughts about yourself and everybody else and projections and then all the reflections of all that and what it means and how many likes and all this shit. It's very intense and not to be done away with because it's a necessary evil for a musician in today's world, especially a weird one. But
it's a fire hose.
Yeah, but it's so much stuff that I feel like I need really intense music that's maxing out to match it and cancel it out so then you have peace, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you have, I can't hang with the, like, soothing music these days.
Yeah.
It needs to be wild for me.
Yeah. I unfortunately couldn't catch your show last night, but have you been addressing this kind of chaotic neuroses in society directly in your shows, like with singing or speaking to the audience about that? Or is that just sort of what you're partly responding to with your music? Maybe not responding to, but as much as like dancing with it.
Yeah, it's more of like a... my feelings about all that become a fuel for the, you know, especially because I do a lot of screams, you know, and so all I have to do is think about what's going on there, and it helps power the scream, which is hopefully, I don't know, maybe a more effective way to handle it than, I mean, I am not really like...
I didn't mean to say you're trying to offer solutions or something.
Oh, no. I mean, I don't know what solutions I could offer except for the catharsis in the moment that I am bringing. Because, I mean, that shit is so deep and complex and ancient and all the shit that's going on. Like, I also am not, like, deeply informed enough about it to get on a soapbox and...
like, intellectually.
Yeah. I mean, I just feel it, and I feel the pain of the people who are suffering. And, I wish I could... I wish I could play for them. That would be sick. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it still spreads some joy and some catharsis, like you said, which isn't always joyful, and that's okay.
Yeah. It isn't always joyful, but it definitely seems to lead to joy. I am often impressed by the type and number of people that come away from such ferocious bejickment with a smile on their face, you know? Like, they'll be like, sometimes there's like there was this, in Eugene, there was this old lady that had a walker, and I, like, took her walker, and I got tangled up in it with my legs, and then I had people drag me around with my back sliding and head sliding on the floor, and she was so delighted, and then I sat on her lap, and she was like, I'm gonna tell my whole family, and this was, she handled 2 hours of straight up raging, you know, sneth music, burnt death metal vibes or whatever, and she was stoked.
Yeah.
So
good.
So yeah, somehow it translates to joy.
Yeah.
You know, that in a way it's a formula, and I feel like that's, you know, one of the potential jobs of musicians. You take all the stuff that's happening in the world, which is always pretty much going to be pretty fucked up because it's the world, and take that whole ball of energy and then feed it through the instrument, music, vocal, kazoo, performance machine, and then what went in was destruction, and what came out was joy. Somehow, it's some weird converter.
The transmutation.
Yes,
of
alchemy.
Like global.
Exactly, transmutation.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the best I can do for now. Right now.
That's so generous, man.
Yeah.
Giving
heck
me the time.
Thank you.
It was really fun.
Thank you very much.
Talking
nice,
with you.
Yeah. Actually, good talk.
Yeah.
Thanks to Rashad for taking some time to hang out with KORCFM. You can find Rashad's music at rashad.bandcamp.com. That's spelled R-U-S-H-A-D. Also at rashadicus.com. And in hundreds of video clips
across all the major social media websites. So keep your ear turned towards Rashadicus, the Cello Goblin, and always be sure to catch him when he comes through Corvallis, where you can get the full body sensorial experience of Rashad Eggleston.
Hi, this is Catherine Fisher in Corvallis, and I am a living organ donor. I successfully donated one of my kidneys to save a life. Live kidney donation is not dangerous. There are no out-of-pocket expenses. In fact, you may even be reimbursed for lost wages. And if you need a kidney later in life, donating now bumps you towards the top of the list later. Most people can lead a healthy life with just one kidney. But right now, Tori, a 24-year-old from Albany, urgently needs a kidney to save his life. Tori has suffered from chronic kidney disease since age 11, and his kidneys are failing. A live organ donation would save him. If you want to donate your kidney to Tori or get more information, visit kidneyfortori.com. That's kidneyfortori.com. Thank you for saving a life.
Framework is a show consecrated to field recording and its use in composition. Join me, Patrick Tubin McGinley, for field recording, phonography, and the art of sound hunting, Sunday evenings at 7 or Tuesday mornings at 5, here on KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis, 105.9 FM.